So a very good evening and a very warm welcome to all of you to Thomas and Jane Carlyle's house. I'm Catherine Utley. I'm a volunteer here at the house. Soon after I started volunteering, about a year ago, Lynn Skippings, the custodian, shared with me an idea she'd had for an evening which would recreate something of the atmosphere of the house when Thomas and Jane lived here, which they did from 1834 until their deaths. Carlyle's conviction was that history should be part of public discourse, because in his view, discussion of the past provided so absolutely crucial an insight into the present, and our understanding of the present couldn't possibly be formed without a proper grasp of what went on in the past. So in his time, the most prominent men and women of the age came to see him here. Ruskin, William Morris, Emerson, Dickens, Mrs. Gaskell, almost everyone you've ever heard of, literally would be queuing up on the pavement outside this house to come here and listen to Thomas, because he was a great talker, and to discuss with him the great affairs of the day. So this evening, to realise Lynn's idea, and with the posthumous approval, we hope, of Thomas Carlyle, we've invited three eminent people to discuss matters of
time.
Three eminent people to discuss matters of topical interest in the context of how the current debate has been shaped by the Victorians. And we're very grateful indeed to all three for accepting our invitation. Ian Hislop, you know, because he's on your television every time you switch it on.
Well, not enough.
Editor of Private Eye for 30 years, writer, broadcaster, presenter of the BBC series on Victorian social reformers, Age of the Do-Gooders. A.N. Wilson, novelist, biographer, historian. His hugely praised books include A Life of Queen Victoria, The Victorians, and After the Victorians. And Simon Heffer, journalist, columnist on the Sunday Telegraph, author of the splendid biography of Carlyle, which is called Moral Desperado, A Life of Thomas Carlyle. And also author of lots of things, but also of High Minds, The Victorians and the Birth of Modern Britain. So Simon has kindly agreed to act as the sort of chairman, the host of the occasion, sort of playing the part almost of Thomas Carlyle. Not too literally, perhaps, because Thomas, I think his idea of conversation was really a monologue, wasn't it? And last thing he wanted was anyone else getting a word in edgeways, but it won't be like that. So thank you all very much indeed for coming, and thank you, wonderful panellists, for coming too, enjoy the evening.
Thank you. Yes, tempting though it is to talk until 5 to 8. I shan't. He used to stand at that fireplace with his pipe and rant, stopping only to puff. But we won't be emulating that. I'm going to take three apophthegms of Carlyle's over the next 45 minutes or so and see how we can relate them to what's going on today. And the first comes from the first lecture he gave in May 1840 on heroes and hero worship and the heroic in history, the one on Odin. The hero as divinity, in which he said, and it's perhaps his most famous quotation in many regards, the history of the world is but the biography of great men. Ian, this gave rise to Carlyle being accused of, quite legitimately accused, of espousing the great man theory of history. Do you think that there's any relics of the great man theory of history around in the world today?
Yeah, I think the great man theory always comes up again when people are fed up with the alternative. So at the moment, I think there are lots of people who believe in the great man theory, because we've had the theory of technocrats in Europe, the theory of dull men, people who don't inspire, but people believe will get the job done. And when people get disillusioned with that, they go back to believing in great men, particularly people who think they are great men believe in it. You know, Europe's full of them, America's got one. But I think the great man theory is very, very prevalent, and it's always there.
But, Andrew, we saw in the 20th century in particular how dangerous and toxic and lethal it is to pursue a politics in which great men decide and dictate the future of nations and indeed whole continents. Do you feel that the experience of what happened in the 30s and 40s is something that will be an insurance policy against that sort of excess ever happening again? Or do you feel that historical memory is so short that at some stage the Carlylean view of the great man will come back into vogue?
I think Carlyle is blamed by a lot of historians. He is blamed for the fact that while Hitler was in the bunker and the Russian guns were firing on Berlin and the Red Army was about to approach, Dr. Goebbels was reading aloud from the book which was written at the top of his house, Carlyle's Frederick the Great. That wasn't Carlyle's fault. I mean, had they been reading Pride and Prejudice, then we would now regard Alton in Hampshire as a rather slightly sinister place. If you read the last chapter of War and Peace, where Tolstoy said that Napoleon had no influence on history at all, it was just the movement of events, and it was just the kind of Hegelian mystic thing which made history work. Great as that book is, you do put it down and you think, well, that must be absolute nonsense. I mean, clearly Napoleon had a huge influence on his times. And clearly when things are in the doldrums, whether great people come forward, men or women, in an unobtrusive way, as Attlee did after the Second World War in this country, most people who look at the history of Britain do think that Attlee was absolutely crucial in influencing the rest of the Labour Party to sit down and create the health service, for example. So I don't think it's necessarily sinister to think that human beings coming out of a period of doldrums and being what Carlyle would call heroic is a sinister idea. But I think you're absolutely right to think that clearly in the 20s and 30s, Mussolini and Hitler and Stalin did believe themselves to be just such saviour figures.
Well, they certainly seem to do away with the idea that might is right, a phrase I don't believe Carlyle ever used, but which some of his disciples did use on his behalf. But, I mean, to be fair to Carlyle, and maybe he was very misguided in this, he seemed always to think that truly great men, as part of their greatness, would always be benign, and they would always do the thing that was what God wanted them to do. And I think, again, it's in The Hero's Divinity. He talks about great men being light-giving fountains, that they turn up and they just radiate beneficence and goodness and enlightenment.
I mean, I think the trouble with Carlyle is that when he decided he liked somebody in the past, he made them benign. And so if you read on in beyond Odin, and in my opinion, Odin wasn't a particularly benign figure. I mean, I don't want the house to be burnt down, but the next chapter, if you remember, is on Muhammad. Hmm. And I think there are many people present who wouldn't necessarily agree with Carlyle's adulation of the prophet or his feeling of cheerfulness as he reflected, because, of course, he was only imagining it as happening. He didn't realise it could actually happen in London. How reassured he would be, if you remember this passage, to walk down the road and hear people shouting out, Allah Akbar. Well, he wouldn't necessarily nowadays, for very obvious reasons, feel reassured. And similarly, when he gets onto the subject of Oliver Cromwell, who was his great hero, of course Cromwell was a great man by any standards, but the idea of him being a benign figure seems to be stretching the truth.
Well, he described Cromwell, if I remember rightly, as the last glimpse of the godlike in England. And this brings us on to his idea. I mean, I think somewhere in Past and Present, he rails against atheism because he says, if we are a land full of atheists who cannot understand the greatness of God, then they will never understand the greatness of an individual. Now, that's a contentious argument. But Ian, you've written a lot about religion. You've written a lot about the Church of England.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there was some truth in that? And do you feel that the Church of England today perhaps should put a little more emphasis on perhaps individual example, which is what Carlyle was talking about, rather than simply on a sort of warm bath of sentiment from the community, which is what it seems to rely upon?
That's what we call a loaded question.
I never said I was going to be an impartial chairman.
No. Nor am I. I suppose one of the things I was trying to do with a number of the Anglican philanthropists was to rescue them essentially from the condescension of history, which is just to assume that all these people were hopelessly naive slightly mad and had no idea what they were doing, and that their faith was irrelevant or actually malign. And in numerous examples of, I think, the great Victorian philanthropists, this wasn't true, whether it was the Earl of Shaftesbury or whether it was, you know, the Rothschild. And I think I was essentially trying to suggest, I mean, it's difficult to believe, it's controversial now, that religion might be a quite a benign force sometimes, occasionally, if at all. In terms of the great man theory, as soon as, you know, I hear Tony Blair talking about God, I reverse my opinion entirely. And I think we have come to a point, and through essentially watching modern theocracies in action, that we don't really want our great men to believe that they, irrespective of their actions, are benign because they say so, and that they will judge their own actions in the light of a God whom they talk to and who only they can interpret his wishes. And Carlyle's religion is strange because he was very evasive on it.
Mm. He was extraordinarily evasive on it because, of course, he didn't have any.
Yeah.
Mm. And Carlyle didn't even bother to go to church on public occasions. Mm. He regarded all churches as utterly absurd. Mm. And openly said so in his first book, Sartor Resartus. People used to ask Carlyle, why do you write in this extraordinary way? And he just said, oh, I just write as my mother spoke. And he said to his mother once, I believe every word of the scriptures in the same way that you taught me, mother. And she said, Thomas Carlyle, you are a liar. She knew that it was untrue. She could read through it. She was clever enough to see that he wasn't a believer in any sense of the term.
His mother caused the problem in the first place, because I think when he was about 3 or 4 years old, he said they'd been to some agricultural depot somewhere near Ekelfecken, where his father was buying a new wheelbarrow. And he said to his mother, did the Lord Almighty make the wheelbarrows in the shop? And, of course, she had to say, well, actually, he didn't. And then you have, I mean, we must remember that Carlyle is a man who brings effectively German culture to, yes, to England through his reading of Schiller and Goethe in the 1810s and 1820s. And I remember Maurice Cowling saying to me when I was writing the book 25 years ago, he described Carlyle as a post-Christian. Yes. And he said he got that sense of post-Christianity from Goethe in particular, but also from Schiller. And Carlyle once said that his idea of religion was that God was immanent in everything.
Yes.
That God is in this table, he's in the fireplace, he's in Ian, he's everywhere. And as you said, that's evasive, because what does it mean?
Yes, and the great men always have a very specific God who wants them to do specific things, who isn't imminent and isn't in everyone. He's in the people on my side and he's not in the people on the other side, and he's in these set of actions and not in these, and therefore I won't be judged by that. So I think that, I know it's Schiller, but it's sort of meant to be all-embracing, but actually it allows people to get away with murder.
So do we think that Carlyle was one of the, I won't say founders, but legitimators of our secular society as we know it today?
Certainly. Absolutely certainly. And, I mean, many people who don't realise they are being influenced by Carlyle are, in fact, espousing Carlyle, including most people who appear on Thought for the Day on Radio 4, even if they're bishops of the Church of England, or perhaps especially if they're bishops of the Church of England. I mean, the idea that good works are a substitute for religious faith, or that you are showing your faith by having a Joe Cox Memorial Day, by just being nice and having street parties, that is, although Carlyle, of course, would have snorted with derision at the idea of it, that emerges from the kind of total secularisation of religious language which Carlyle indulged in all his early influential books.
Well, I've seen you write pieces. I'm not necessarily about
sure they were absolute rubbish, whatever.
No. In which you suggested that it's perfectly reasonable to come to a point where you think, I don't believe in any of this, but I think it's better that people do.
Yes.
And that seemed to be what Carlyle thought. He thought, I personally, you know, find this...
Well, that's why he denounced,
untrue, but I need everyone else to do it.
That's why he denounced atheism.
Yeah.
But I don't think he was cynical in the sense that Charles Maurras, for example, was cynical. He just thought, obviously, it's all rubbish.
Yeah.
But it's
useful.
Much better for people to believe in Catholicism. He wasn't like that.
Mm.
But he believed that he was actually more dangerous than that, because he thought what they're really believing when they say is all my beliefs.
Yeah.
I mean, Carlyle beliefs, not my beliefs.
Well, I remember, Andrew, very memory, we were talking about Victorian belief and how seriously they took Christianity. And Andrew said, well, for the average Victorian person, I mean, Jesus was all very well, but you couldn't put him in charge of a hill station. You know, the chap would let everyone down. And I also...
That is what they thought.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely right. And I think that must come, I mean, you know, partly from him, that idea that this stuff won't do.
Well, also, you may know the reasoned defence of Pontius Pilate that James Fitzjames Stevens makes in Liberty, Equality, Fraternity, which he made, having been John Stuart Mill's barrister in the case against Governor Eyre in 1866. And he, under the huge influence of Carlyle, realised not only that, in his view, John Stuart Mill was completely wrong, that he took this utterly idealistic view of the working classes, which was going to end in, if pursued, was going to end in chaos, but also that the general view of religion was wrong, and that if you'd been Pontius Pilate, of course you'd have crucified Jesus. You know, what would they say in Rome if you didn't? You know, you'd be out of a job. So it's all very toxic. We're going to move on 3 years. I'm going to press the fast-forward button of life to 1843, and Carlyle writes Past and Present, which I think is probably his greatest book in terms of its influence that it had at the time and the influence it still continues to have today. And in chapter 13, he coins the phrase, democracy that means despair of finding any heroes to govern you. Ian, Private Eye has been very insistent that Brexit was a mistake. You don't have to read between the lines to see that. And over the last 8 months...
Yeah. What, to see that it's a mistake, Simon?
Well, no, to see that Private Eye thinks it's a mistake.
Oh, sorry. Easy confusion to make.
And I wondered how... People like you obviously were very much on the Remain side of the argument in June. Look at remarks made 170 years ago by Carlyle about democracy and about the dangers of what he called in 1867 the Niagara Leap of completed democracy, the idea of allowing people who might not have as many A-levels or university degrees as you exercise the vote. Are you? Do you feel slightly more in sympathy with the Carlylean view now than you did before the 23rd of June?
Yeah, obviously. No, I mean, the problem with Carlyle's view, which, again, it didn't extend at the time to any women or much further than that. He was scared of mob rule. I mean, this and the French Revolution absolutely terrified everybody. Mm. And, you know, I mean, with reason, that if you let that sort of straightforward demagoguery leading to, you know, those votes take over, then you would get nothing but chaos. And order was his thing. But again, it was order on his own terms. I don't have a problem with losing votes and with anybody in Britain being allowed to vote however they like. All I feel is I don't have to stop disagreeing with them because the vote has been lost. It was not one vote once forever, never to be repeated. It was a vote. Mm. I mean, in a similar way, when the Trump people say, you lost, suck it up, I say, well, he wasn't voted in as supreme dictator. He was president, and he'll have to put up with Congress, and he'll have to put up with people who disagree with him, and have to put up with the press, and have to put up with all the other bits of democracy that aren't one vote, one time. So, no, I don't feel any more sympathy with Carlyle for not wanting, essentially out of a mistrust of the people, to allow them to have a vote.
There's been a lot of debate in America since November the 8th about whether their democracy functions as effectively as it might. Andrew, do you feel that Carlyle does have anything to teach us as we look at our democratic structures, whether here or in any other country?
I think he had a total contempt, Carlyle, for democracy, the ballot box, the belief that the ballot box in any country would prevent this great movement of history. He was utterly sceptical of the political process, and he would have agreed with this much of Dr. Johnson, that most schemes of political improvement are very laughable things. And he wouldn't have thought that the country would be any better if it was run by dukes.
He was always looking for these noble people who were going to run it, whoever they were.
If there was a great person,
Well, he believed in...
Or a house full of great people. I never understood how that was meant to...
Well, I mean, we have. I think Simon was quite right to remind us there haven't been any such people probably since the time of Napoleon, he would say. Carlyle.
Carlyle believed in an aristocracy of morality, if you like. He believed that there were those people who had it in them to behave as God would wish them to behave for the common good. And that's, of course, why he liked Cromwell so much. It's why he adulated Martin Luther, because he felt that Martin Luther had exploded some great contrick being perpetrated on the people of Europe by the Vatican.
Yes,
and
he certainly thought that. I mean, he was, although he wasn't a real religious believer of any sort, he shared with the majority of English-speaking people in the 19th century a deep distrust of Catholicism in any form, and a sort of gut anti-Catholicism. So that's why he revered Martin Luther.
But the only contemporary figure of his that I can recall him being sympathetic to and absolutely stricken when he died was Peel. Because he thought Peel had been amazingly brave in taking on most of his own party in repealing the Corn Laws.
Yes.
And when Peel was chucked off his horse and killed in 1850, I mean, Carlyle wrote to a number of people saying that this was the end of England,
yes,
that this man was the only hope for the future.
Well, Carlyle was, I mean, although I've said he was cynical and negative about the political process, the reason he was that he hated the effects that political systems had on most people. He was a working-class man himself. He knew that the Corn Laws were making people hungry. Mm. They were actually going to lead to starvation.
Mm.
And I think the fact that the lives of ordinary people, if one's allowed to call them that, I mean, most of us, are not improved by politicians or by political systems. And he was acutely conscious of that.
But just before we come off this subject of his regard for democracy, I wonder, Ian, how you think he would have reacted to the, not to last year's referendum, but to the one 2.5 years ago in Scotland. I mean, this was a man who, whenever he went to Scotland, which he did frequently, and wrote back to his wife or to his friends here, he always put his address and put NB at the bottom. It was North Britain. Throughout his writing, he uses the term English as synonymous with British. It's almost as though, although he is a Scot and has a very profound Scottish identity, it's as though he has become subsumed into the English imperial project, if you like, the minute he gets down here. How do you feel he would have reacted to the fact that there was a referendum?
I'm sure he'd been pleased by the result.
Yes, I'm sure he would.
This is the voice of the people, democracy working.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, my grandfather, who was Scottish entirely, lived in Ayr, and all his friends were perfectly happy to describe themselves as English to anybody outside Britain when they introduced themselves. I think it's you know, Scottish nationalism in its current form is much, much more more recent than we imagine. So, no, I mean, I think that sentiment is still, there's still quite a lot of it in Scotland.
But, of course, also the Scots in Carlyle's lifetime were very prominently engaged on the imperial project.
Yeah, well, there's that marvellous book, The Scottish Empire.
Yeah, I mean, they're settling large chunks of Canada. They are running hill stations in India.
Yeah.
They've got their missionaries out in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, the military is full of them, particularly the quartermasters.
I think to say the biggest We Free congregation in the world is in Malawi.
Yeah.
So they've got...
I grew up in the sort of fag end of empire. Sort of, my father was a Scottish civil engineer. I had no idea there were any others. I didn't know the English did civil engineering. It was just never never pointed out to me. So yes, I mean, I think he.
And also remember, during Carlyle's lifetime, the English universities only taught Latin, Greek and mathematics. Yep. So if you wanted to study medicine, you had to go to Edinburgh or Glasgow or one of the London teaching hospitals. So the likelihood is that the doctors throughout the empire would be Scots, the engineers would be Scots.
My grandfather said there were two acceptable universities that it would be all right for his grandchildren to go to, and they were Glasgow and Edinburgh.
Yes.
And when we went down south, it was a bit of a betrayal.
And also, if you were a working-class person in mid-19th century or early 19th century Scotland, you had a chance to go to university, as Carlyle and others like him showed. Whereas in England, you're Jude the Obscure. It's you haven't got a prayer.
Of course.
We've touched on this question of the waste of human potential in the 1840s at the time of what was known as the Condition of England question, where you've got rather great novels, I think, like Mary Barton and others written. You've got rather bad novels such as Coningsby and Sybil being written about it. But Carlyle in again in Past and Present, where he's talking about the lives of the people who live around St. Edmundsbury in Suffolk, around the abbey, that's run by this very benign figure called Abbot Samson, talks about the most perfect feudal times. And he doesn't have any doubt that in medieval England, in the 13th century, when Abbot Samson was operating, there was a real sense of duty on the part of those who had to help those who hadn't. Now, clearly, the population was far smaller in 13th century England than it was in 1841 or 1842. I think the 41 census, there were about 27 million people in the British Isles, so it was growing rapidly. But Carlyle had this terrible moment when he was researching Oliver Cromwell in Huntingdonshire, and he rode one morning past the St. Ives workhouse and saw lots of relatively young, able-bodied men sitting on the steps of the workhouse with nothing to do and just waiting for the time when the doors opened and even they could go back indoors and lie down. And this was what really motivated his anger. And that's what directed him to write Past and Present.
Yes, it was. And also he shared... I mean, the funny thing was, I've said he was anti-Catholic, as they all were, but at the same time, he shared with Cobbett, which is where he got it from, the sense that the great disaster which ever occurred to these islands was the dissolution of the monasteries.
Yeah.
And the abolition of education for the poor, basically, which the Scots carried on. They carried on educating the poor, and the English gave up educating women and the poor after the Reformation. And he was acutely aware of that.
Mm. But also, as he says in Past and Present, every man was given a job. And in return for his job was given bread and water, I'm being metaphorical. And he saw certainly no benefit in a welfare state.
But that was, it wasn't just Carlyle, that was a great Victorian state of mind, that you could compare a wonderful feudal past, you know, they all did this, you know. And some
Young England took that inspiration from Carlyle.
And it was... hospitality, looking after the poor, creating work, almshouses as opposed to workhouses. It was a vision of the past as it might have been. I mean, I'm not sure medievalists would actually credit that there's a great deal of truth in that vision. It was, as ever, a useful stick with which to beat the present. And I think a lot of that, what he's writing, is a reaction to, you know, industrialisation, to a much greater spread between rich and poor, which, you know, again, we are seeing again. And then these arguments come up again. You're saying, what is the responsibility of the very rich, particularly if they've done particularly well, as they had at that period, and as they've done again through these forces of history? What is their responsibility to the people who provide their wealth? And for the Victorians, I mean, a lot of them looking at it, and, you know, this is where Dickens made it real, was they do nothing. Absolutely nothing. And so you wanted to be able to say there was a time in this country where we had a sense of social responsibility. Yes. And you get that again. You'll get it again now.
And also, as Dickens satirised, Carlyle had a great hatred of utilitarianism. And this idea that everyone had a use, and when that use was gone, they were basically pointless. Mm. And Carlyle seemed to have worked out that the aristocracy, which of course had its faults, did still have a sense of noblesse oblige, whereas it was those who were quite recently sprung from the working class who were the hardest against what had been their own people. But I'm thinking particularly in at the time when Shaftesbury is trying to pass the Factory Acts, when he's still Lord Ashley in the 1840s, John Bright is telling him there's no need for them.
Yes.
Because actually...
the liberals were against the Factory Act.
Yes.
Harriet Martineau thought that if people got their thumbs chopped off by these new machines being brought into effect, they should keep their hands out of the way. She wrote articles to that effect.
And there was a huge interest. I mean, you know, MP after MP who came from mining towns or constituencies where the vested interests were got up and said, well, you know, if we don't let children work, there'll be no income for the family, which is what they say in Colombia now about the coal mines or about, you know, Bangladesh. Yes. It is exactly the same argument.
It's the same phenomenon of urbanisation. And the monasteries in Past and Present and the land owned by the benign aristocracy, they were rural. And what was happening in the 19th century was that, for the first time, the population was becoming increasingly and eventually in the majority urban. Mm. And the slaves, the factory slaves, the mill slaves, had nowhere to escape from it. In the country, you had your benign landowner or your abbot or your neighbour who could see the state of poverty in which you were living. In the town, you were just a nobody.
Riccardo had quite a good point there, didn't he? Because there was an essential rootlessness to many people who were living in these cities. Mm. I only learned a couple of years ago when I was researching my last book that many of the people who ended up in Manchester in the 1800s and 1810s had migrated en masse from Buckinghamshire because there wasn't much work to be had in northern Buckinghamshire. And so they just went up the A5 and ended up in Manchester and worked in mills there. But they left behind them these communities. Now, however hard agricultural work was, they had a community, they had a church, they often had a landowner. They may not have been religiously observant in a way that would have had any sincerity attached to it.
I think there is a case. I mean, one of the great Victorian facts I enjoy is that the Victorian Church of England built enormous churches in the cities, saying, we will fill these churches. There are all these people who need the church.
Yes.
And it was slowly pointed out to them, the reason people don't go to church in the cities is because they've come from the country, and the two people they don't want to see ever again are the parson and the squire. and that's what they like about city life. So, again, I think you have to have a slightly more cynical view about this ideal, benign, rural.
But anyway, I mean, Carlyle was utterly, as I said earlier, contemptuous of the.
Yes, and he would have pointed out how appalling, the crofters' lives were, or any of those. We were entirely few.
But he also thought if you went to one of those big churches the Victorians had built, you'd been wasting your time. Mm. Because he thought that the Puseyites and people who were obsessed by what you wear in church and so on, it was all rubbish. I mean, he repeatedly and openly said that. You'd just be taught rubbish if you went to those churches. So, and of course, he was against them.
Yeah.
And he would see through, as the working classes on the whole did see through, the strange motives people had for building them. Even though we think it was very benign of the great architects like Butterfield and so on to build churches in the middle of Manchester.
All of us have a great interest in Carlyle's writing, and I've always found him a remarkable stylist. I find him very entertaining to read, even if what he is writing is slightly far-fetched or garbage or even quite offensive. But there is a problem for those of us who want to encourage others to read Carlyle these days, which is that so much of what he believed is either impossible to defend, such as his views on black people, or what he said about the great man theory of history, which appears to have been disproved by Hitler, Stalin, various other unpleasant characters from the recent past.
One thing we ought to emphasise, I mean, it's emerged in the things that we've been saying, he is a very funny writer.
Yeah.
And he is primarily a satirist, in fact. And that's why he wanted to write in the way that his funny deliberately funny, amusing old mother used to speak.
Yeah.
And giving everybody nicknames and so forth all the way through the Frederick the Great book, for instance.
But that is the problem. The early satires are him at his most funny, but they're very difficult to get now without footnotes and without being able to measure the tone of voice. Whereas the later stuff where, all satirists turn into terrific old bores, just what happens, that you can read because he's gone straight. And you know that that voice is what he now thinks, and it's what he thinks about women or what he thinks about the colonies or whatever. And that it's much easier to read his later stuff and dislike him than it is to read the earlier stuff and think, well, that's, as Andrew said, the sort of criticism of absolutely everything. It's pretty difficult to get, isn't it?
I've never found it so. I always thought he was one of the most accessible and funny writers I've ever read.
Right. You have to tune into him, though, don't you?
You have to imagine it in a Scottish voice.
No, right.
Yes, and standing at that fireplace and actually ranting it. I mean, there's some fantastic jokes in Frederick the Great. I mean, no one could get to the end of all eight volumes in one piece if there hadn't been some jokes on the way. and there are, and he's particularly good. Again, it's rather a morbid subject, but he's particularly good about Frederick's appalling relations with his father. And he writes that both with great humanity and with a certain amount of wit, because otherwise you'd find it unbearable to read. But, Andrew, how would you encourage someone who was a Carlyle virgin, how would you encourage them to to come to Carlisle, and what would you tell them to read first of all?
Well, in spite of having named all these great books, I would recommend a book called The Life of John Sterling.
Well, yes.
John Sterling was the kind of clergyman who's mocked in the Daily Mail nowadays. He was a wishy-washy Anglican who couldn't really believe anything. And he went on agonising and agonising. The funniest bits of the book are when the young John Sterling, wondering whether he should be ordained, goes up to Highgate to meet the aged Coleridge. And he's apparently talking about Hegel, but you can't really work out what he's talking about. It's terribly funny. And John Sterling comes down the hill thinking, well, have I just heard the wisest person in Europe talking to me, or was it a load of old rubbish? And occasionally Carlisle surfaces and saying, what are you doing, young man, wasting your time, sort of wishy-washing away when you could be doing something really great and you had the capacity to be a great man. It's a wonderful book, and it's a wonderfully sympathetic account of what it's like to be a hopelessly muddled young person, which certainly I was, and now I'm a hopelessly muddled old person. So perhaps that's why I like it. But it is a comic book, but it's a warm comic book.
Ian, where would you advise any young person who asks your advice on literary matters? Would you advise them to read Carlisle? And if so, where would you suggest that they would start?
Well, I think it's time for a best of.
I agree with you about that too.
Perhaps a really good selection with some biographical notes and the new stuff about Jane that's come out, and make it more of a treat rather than saying there's some very long books and there's some you won't get.
And I also think it should be done in a frame of a book like Thea Holmes' wonderful book about this house, the Carlisle home. So you could imagine what it was like coming into this room and meeting them and how funny they both were. How marvellous Jane was, really. I mean, I know she was sort of one of the most tiresome people who's ever lived, but so was Carlisle. She was also wonderfully entertaining and brilliantly funny person in her own right.
Yes, I mean, it was a very good joke about their marriage. And it's a good thing they married each other so he could only make two people miserable rather than four. It applies to so many of one's friends.
But I suppose in terms of their appeal, the fact that this house was a hub, to use a ghastly 21st century phrase, of people, whether they were potential revolutionaries like Mazzini or other intellectuals like John Stuart Mill, that people would, as I think Catherine said earlier, queue up on the pavement outside to come in here and talk to the pair of them.
It must have been fun.
People
wouldn't have come.
It must have been
interesting, not because a lot of people write about how tiresome he was, but he must have been funny and amusing live.
Yes. They must have been riveting people. They must, and not just entertaining, not just perhaps unintentionally funny from time to time, but also, and we know this of Jane particularly, very warm people. And people who were saying things and taking conversation and thought in directions that few other people in London were doing. And, you know, without the shall we say, the earnestness of John Stuart Mill. I mean, we remember Carlisle quotes, I think it's at the start of Past and Present, Schiller, Ernstes des Leben. He wanted to avoid earnestness in life at all times. You know, for him, although he was rather dour and he was, you know, obviously very screwed up in many ways, he wanted to bring light into people's lives. Isn't that fair?
He definitely did. And the Goethe last words and motto, mehr Licht, they would have definitely been his as well. And also his other thing, which he says in one of my favourites, that the first book he ever wrote, Sartor, Resartus, that the everlasting yea, das ewige ja, he did, although he was negative about human institutions and things, he was never negative about life itself or its potentiality. And the great sin was to waste your life. Mm. And the awful thing about systems was the way they encouraged people to waste their lives.
Ian, was there anything you wanted to say finally before I invite our distinguished audience
No? Last word.
Well, distinguished audience, would you like to ask any questions?
What would a Carlislean have said Carlisleanism was?
I think one is the idea that societies do get their comeuppance. I mean, if they're badly run and if there's injustice, eventually justice will prevail. I think he really did believe in the... He thought what the Old Testament was about was that injustice eventually, or irrationality, would eventually be answered by the great man or great woman appearing in history as great man, to rescue people, and that what the French Revolution was an attempt to get rid of the Ancien Régime, which was illogical and unjust and badly organized.
So it's a theory of history.
It's a theory of history combined with what I think Simon was talking about, this Goethean idea that a wise human life is one in which we live in a perpetual state of awe at the mystery of science and the mystery of nature. Goethe wasn't religious in the sense of going to church, but he thought that if we couldn't feel awe in the presence of nature, then there was something wrong with us. And Carlyle felt that very strongly.
I mean, Ian's touched on earlier the French Revolution as an influence on behaviour of people in the ruling class in this country, and also in the literate middle class, like Carlyle. I think that Carlyle fundamentally was a man who believed in an ordered society. And if you were to ask me what I meant by a Carlylean, it would be somebody who takes an absolutely firm view that the society must be ordered. And he doesn't talk about hierarchy, because he doesn't really like priests. But he talks, it's one of his many jokes, of a heroarchy. And that ordered society, in his view, is going to be run by people who, because of their superior morality and their godlike qualities, are going to be ordained to rule. And they should be allowed to rule, because they are wise and others are stupid, and that any interference in that natural order by the ballot box is fundamentally wrong. I mean, if I were going to recommend somebody to start reading Carlyle, and I would say, you know, have a glass of whiskey and read the Latter-day pamphlets, because they are brilliant journalism. They're mostly deeply offensive, but they are brilliant journalism. And if you want to understand what was driving this man at his peak in his mid-50s, it's in there. Mm-hmm. And the idea of the ordered society and his railing against attempts to disorder society. Mm. Are there? I mean, he rails against Hudson, the railway king, who was a great fraudster at the time of railway mania in the 1840s. Not just because he had exploited the greed of investors, but because Carlyle didn't, although he used railways, didn't fundamentally like railways.
No, he thought they were immoral. They would mix up the classes who'd get ideas above their station and start going to places.
And they break up communities, you know, people.
And the jiggling effect of the carriages would make people a bit sort of frisky in ways that were unacceptable. He wrote all this.
Yeah, he was very much against progress in that sense.
But I, if someone asked me, I would say that order thing is extraordinary. I mean, I think we underestimate how terrified everybody was of the French Revolution. I mean, and it's not just looking at satirical prints. That amazing Zoffany painting, which, you know, did the rounds and everybody went and looked at it. And it was themselves being murdered by sort of women and black people, and there's Jews in the background as well. I mean, these people are all going to come and get us. And it absolutely terrified people. And Carlyle's, I mean, he's a brilliant writer, and his description of the French Revolution was one that was sort of constantly extracted and taken out and said, look at this, and it is very frightening. So I think he fed into that. And so a lot of his writings, it's about chaos, about disorder, about bad management, as much as it is about ethics.
Yes, I totally agree with that. And just in his defence, because obviously one strand of all this thinking would lead to thinking that Carlyle was a fascist. And certainly the fascists believed Carlyle was a fascist in the 30s. He was one of their heroes. But in fact, he wasn't, because I think that he, for the very reasons you talk about, that he would have seen them as part of the terrifying revolutionary process. And his portrait of Robespierre really is a foretaste of what you get with Hitler.
Yeah.
And he was in no sense on the side of Robespierre and the abuse of power.
Well, I better make this the concluding remark, sadly, because I didn't want Catherine to get cross with me. But one of his other interesting essays is on Dr. Franthea, who was the dictator of Paraguay. And Franthea used to take people who weren't behaving very well and walk them under the gallows. And Carlyle finds this frightfully funny. He does hang some of them if they don't behave subsequently, but he says, you know, isn't this brilliant, Franthea, to take them for a walk under the gallows so they see what's going to happen to them if they don't behave and follow the normal order of things? And this obsession with order is in everything he writes, really, from the earliest to Shooting Niagara, which is more or less the last thing that he writes. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.